From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Royal Tenenbaums is a new film about a family of precocious geniuses whose adult lives are in ruin. The film stars Gene Hackman and Angelica Houston as the parents, with Gwyneth Paltrow, Ben Stiller, and Luke Wilson as their children. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the director and co-writer of the film, Wes Anderson. He also made the movies Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. Also, we talk about the early use of chemical weapons in World War I with Eric Crotty, author of the new book Chemical and Biological Warfare. He's a senior research associate at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush told Russia today the United States is pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. The president said the U.S. is taking the steps so it can build a shield against nuclear missile attacks. Mr. Bush says those attacks could come from terrorists.
Today, as the events of September the 11th made all too clear, the greatest threats to both our countries come not from each other or other big powers in the world, but from terrorists who strike without warning or rogue states who seek weapons of mass destruction.
The president promised to pursue closer ties with Russia, but Russian President Vladimir Putin criticized the decision to abandon the treaty. NPR's Lauren Sheets reports from Moscow.
Putin called President Bush's unilateral exit from the ABM treaty a mistake, but the Kremlin leader said the decision had not been unexpected. Putin said Russia had done everything in its power to save the 30-year-old agreement. He assured Russians the country's national security would not suffer as a result. Other Russian politicians are condemning Bush's decision in harsher terms. Vladimir Lukin of the liberal Yabloko party lambasted Bush's refusal to compromise over missile defense. He said it showed America was not grateful for Russia's support for the war in Afghanistan and the anti-terror coalition. President Bush says the ABM treaty is a relic of the Cold War, which no longer serves U.S. security interests. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
The Osama bin Laden videotape has been released to the public. On it, bin Laden says he knew of the September attacks in advance and that he was pleasantly surprised that the damage was greater than expected. The Pentagon provided the translation. A White House spokesman says President Bush didn't need a videotape to tell him what he already knew, that Osama bin Laden was behind the September terror attacks. A few al-Qaeda holdouts remain in Kandahar almost a week after the Taliban surrender. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Kandahar that some of those injured holdouts are at the main hospital.
An exhausted Dr. Ali, one of just four physicians at the main Kandahar hospital, says about 300 injured al-Qaeda fighters flooded the ward on the night of the Taliban surrender. But early the next morning, he says, dozens of Taliban and Qaeda vehicles came to pick them up. 14 badly injured were left behind. The doctor only noticed the grenades one fighter had on him when he took him in for an X-ray. Ali called the patients crazy, saying one refused an operation when he heard music from the radio in the operating room. They say only medical staff should approach or they'll blow themselves up and anyone nearby. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Kandahar, Afghanistan.
Stock prices were generally lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 128 points to close at 97.66. Declines led advances 2-1 on volume of 1.4 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index fell 64 points to 1946, and the S&P 500 was off 17. This is NPR News. The United States said today it would not follow Israel and cut ties with Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the U.S. can't afford to abandon its mediation between Israelis and Palestinians, and he said the U.S. continues to recognize Arafat.
Yasser Arafat is the elected head of the Palestinian Authority and reflects the leadership that the Palestinians wish to have. So he still has that authority, that mantle of leadership given to him by the Palestinian people, and we will continue to work with him.
The Israeli cabinet decided yesterday to break ties with the Palestinian leader, saying he was no longer relevant. The vote followed a series of Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians. Two U.S. Airways concourses at Boston's Logan Airport were closed today because of a security problem. Steve Sine of member station WBUR in Boston reports.
The concourses were closed for about an hour when Federal Aviation Administration officials determined that the people staffing security checkpoints were improperly trained. Airport spokesman Phil Orlandella says several hundred passengers had to be rescreened.
It was a precaution. There was no breach of security. Nothing was found. The terminals were reopened.
The security workers were employed by Argonbright, the embattled company that's been criticized for past security lapses. Tomorrow is Argonbright's last day as a security vendor at Logan Airport. For NPR News, I'm Steve Sein in Boston.
Researchers have moved one step closer to providing relief for thousands of Americans who suffer from sickle cell anemia. Scientists say they've succeeded in curing lab mice of the disorder through an experiment involving stem cells, genes, and a modified HIV virus. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual Financial Group, a global diversified financial services organization with more than $220 billion in assets under management, on the web at massmutual.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Wes Anderson, is the director and co-writer of The Royal Tenenbaums, one of the new films opening for the holidays. Anderson also made the films Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. The Royal Tenenbaums is a comedy about a family. Royal Tenenbaum, played by Gene Hackman, and his wife Etheline, played by Angelica Houston, separated when their children were young. Royal is part businessman, part con man. He runs a lot of emotional swindles on his family. He's never accepted his adopted daughter as an authentic member of the family. The three Tenenbaum kids were child geniuses, but when they grew up, they were each stunted by family disasters and betrayals. The grown-up children are played by Ben Stiller, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Luke Wilson. In this scene, the father, Royal, is broke. He owes so much money to the luxurious hotel he's been living in that he's been evicted. Having no place to go, he tries to return to the Tenenbaum home, where he knows he will not be welcome. So he needs a scheme. He tells the family he's dying of cancer and wants to reconcile.
I've missed the hell out of you, my darlings. Well, you know that, though, don't you?
I hear you're dying.
So they tell me.
I'm sorry.
Well, I've had a good run.
You don't look so sick, Dad.
Thank you.
What have you got?
I got a pretty bad case of cancer.
Ugh, how long are you gonna last?
Not long.
A month, a year?
About 6 weeks. Let me get to the point. The three of you and your mother are all I've got, and I love you more than anything.
Oh, oh!
Chaz, let me finish here. Now, I've got 6 weeks to set things right with you, and I aim to do it. Will you give me a chance?
No.
You speak for everyone?
I speak for myself.
Well, you've made your views known. I'll let somebody else do some of the talking now.
What do you propose to do?
I can't say, really. Make up for lost time, I suppose. First thing I want to do is take you out to see your grandmother at some point.
I haven't been out there since I was six.
I haven't been out there at all. I was never invited.
Well, she wasn't your real grandmother, and I never knew how much interest you had, sweetie. Anyway, you're invited now.
Thanks.
Wes Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, dysfunctional family is perhaps the most common subject now in contemporary fiction and in a lot of movies. What made you think that you could take on the subject and still have something else to say? It seems like so much has already been said.
Yeah. Well, my writing partner, Owen Wilson, and I, he'd always been encouraging me to write about my parents' divorce. He always thought there was something there that would be a good basis for something. And so that's what I thought we were doing. But the more we worked on the script, the less it had anything to do with my family or my parents' divorce. And the more it was sort of invented and the more dysfunctional it became. It kind of just went off on its own. So I sort of feel like as we developed it, we invented a lot of new things, and then it kind of started to find its way back to people that we knew, and little bits of things from real life. But it was sort of like when it became not about my family that it started to get really severe.
Well, there is a line I particularly liked about divorce in the movie when Gene Hackman is explaining to the three children that he and his wife are separating, that the parents are separating. One of the kids says, "Daddy, is it our fault?" And he says, Well, it's true. We did have to make many sacrifices to have you children.
Yeah, the worst thing, an honest answer is probably a terrible idea under those situations.
Did you pop the question and get an answer like that when your parents were divorcing?
Well, that's funny because there's a scene, you know, where they're talking to the father about are they going to split up, and that's a real scene I have two brothers, and the three of us had this conversation with our father, but none of the father's answers are anything like what my father said. Every answer that the Gene Hackman character gives is the truth, which has got to be highly destructive to the children.
So your father gave you the right answers?
He gave us the right answers, yeah.
Each of the children in the Tenenbaum family has a certain look that they stick with through all or most of the movie. I'd like you to choose a couple of characters and talk about the look that you gave them and why.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing in the story is that they're all sort of they're sort of stuck emotionally in the same place where they were 20 years ago, and they're also stuck in terms of the clothes that they wear and the way their rooms look and everything. It's all sort of just cemented in about 1978. So the tennis player that that Luke Wilson plays, Richie, is he wears a headband for the whole movie. He always looks like he's just about to head out to the courts, even though he hasn't picked up a racket in 6 years or something. And his whole look is sort of modeled on Bjorn Borg in the late 70s.
Right.
Gwyneth Paltrow, her character wears one of these like fourth grader Lacoste dresses that looks like a big shirt and a mink coat. I don't know why those go together, but somehow they seem to. And penny loafers. Ben Stiller goes through the whole movie in a red Adidas warm-up that identical to the ones worn by his two sons. And I think the idea for that, I was just sort of thinking they could always spot each other in a crowd. It's like for safety purposes. He's obsessed with their safety. So
because his wife died in a plane crash.
Right.
Then there's the boy next door who desperately wants to be part of the Tenenbaum family and is always showing up at the door when he's a child. The grown-up version of this character is played by Owen Wilson, who's also your screenwriting partner for the film. Are you familiar with this kind of character, or is this kind of character based on you? Was there a family in your life that you really envied because they had such like an interesting house and interesting parents and
creative
siblings?
No, very much. I mean, as much as sort of devoted as I am to my own family, I do remember a series of families over the years that I always was trying to get myself adopted into. Because of the things that were going on in their houses, and that's definitely where this Eli Cash character that Owen plays comes from. That's actually a good example of what's invented in the movie and what comes from real life, and hopefully kind of how we rely on both of those things, because the character that he plays is initially this sort of concoction of a kind of a Cormac McCarthy, but it would be like Cormac McCarthy if he was living in New York and going out to cocktail parties every night. He's a Western novelist, but I think he wouldn't be very comfortable on horseback. You know, I think his fringe leather jackets are custom made, probably in L.A. but the real kind of heart of that character has to do with his. Him growing up, you know, across the street from this family that he really wanted to be a part of, and his kind of longing to be one of them.
You know, Owen Wilson, who plays this character, he has one brother who is also starring in your movie, and another brother who also acts. So they seem like the kind of creative family that the Tenenbaum family is based on. I think you lived with all the brothers at some point in college or after college.
Yeah, well, you know, we all lived together for years and years and years when we were trying to get our first movie done, and which was Bottle Rocket, and then we were making the second movie. And, you know, Owen and Luke and I were living together up until just, you know, 2 years ago or so.
Did you want to be part of their family?
Well, I was, so I didn't have to. I joined that one. You know, their family is not like the Tenenbaums either, but... But the four of us, you know, were sort of together so much that I just felt like, you know, I feel the same way about them as I do about my brothers, basically. And Andrew actually appears in the new. Luke is in the movie, and Owen is in the movie. Andrew Wilson also appears in the movie three times. The Owen's older brother. One of his appearances is his hand, which has a BB embedded in it. And one of the stories in the movie is how one of them was shot with a BB gun early on, and then we see the BB still in his hand 20 years later, which Andrew has. So it's hard to replace. You know, that's crucial casting. There aren't that many people who have that BB, so.
How did he get a BB in his hand?
Well, Owen shot him.
Oh, Owen shot him?
Yeah.
Oh, well, at least it came in handy for your movie.
Yeah, no, it came in handy in all kinds of ways.
Wes Anderson is my guest. He directed and co-wrote the new movie, The Royal Tenenbaums. Now, there's three children in this movie. One of them is an adopted daughter, and she's married to a neurologist who's very much like Oliver Sacks. He has long white hair. He writes books of case studies about patients with rare perceptual and neurological disorders. I think it's just so clever to base a character on Oliver Sacks. What inspired you to do that?
Well, you know, I mean, I love Oliver Sacks. I love his books, and I also love his... He had a series on PBS, little documentaries that would sort of profile different case studies that he was working on, and I've always found him very charming and very peculiar, so he, you know, he was just someone who I was drawn to, Bill Murray somehow seemed like the right guy to play it. He has a white beard. So Bill Murray, you know, grew this beard. I think it was one of the worst experiences of his life. I don't think he likes to wear a beard. But I do feel like, yeah, you know, he was just the right guy for it. He has a very nice feeling about him.
Did you make up the perceptual disorder that the boy he's studying has?
I think yes. He's described as having Heinsbergen syndrome, which basically we just took every possible perceptual disorder that we could come up with and threw them all together. So he's colorblind and he's dyslexic, and he has a highly acute sense of hearing. So I don't know exactly what that adds up to, but.
The story of the Royal Tenenbaums is set in New York, but it's an idealized version of the city, and all the landmarks are fake. Instead of the 92nd Street Y, there's the 375th Street Y. I don't think there even is a 375th Street.
Yeah, I think the 375th Street Y would probably be in Yonkers.
Right, right. Yeah. Why did you want to shoot in New York but have a kind of fake version of New York that you were operating with?
One thing that was one of the my sort of initial thoughts about it, I kind of am thinking about the setting before much of anything else, and I just had this idea of this sort of exaggerated version of New York, and I feel like, and you know, which is just fun to make up all the details to the place, but also I feel like it sort of creates a setting where the kind of unusual behavior of the characters can seem appropriate somehow, because the setting is so exaggerated and is a little bit unreal.
And why did you set your movie in New York?
Well, because I've always had this sort of semi-obsession with New York and all the things that I've felt like it represented, you know, having to do a lot of which came from the New Yorker magazine, which was my consistent exposure to New York for you know, all through high school. And I always felt like it seemed like people were up to so many different things around the city. All these people had their own little projects, and that's kind of what the movie is partly about, I think. And then I live there now, so it's kind of a big thing for me.
In your movie, The Royal Tenenbaums, the family lives in, well, this almost mansion in New York. It's an old building with a turret. I think you'd call that a turret, the rounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a flag on the top.
Yeah. Now, I read about you as a kid. You used to draw pictures of dream mansions that you would have liked to live in. How did you get that sense of place, that sense of interest in mansions?
Well, you know, for a little while I wanted to be an architect. But I was also, along with being interested in buildings, I was also, for a period of time, I'm embarrassed to say that I was obsessed with being rich. I was interested in limousines, and I was interested in mansions, and I was interested in the fanciest restaurants. And it was like a James Bond kind of thing that I was really drawn to. I wanted to learn how to play Baccarat. And so I think between the ages of about 8 and 12 or something, that was what I was reading about.
Did you watch a lot of James Bond films?
Yeah, I was obsessed with James Bond. Yeah.
What was your house like?
Well, our house, you know, in some ways, it was the ways that it resembles the house in the movie is that I feel like there was always a lot of kind of encouragement to take on personal projects, and there were always people working on their own separate things in the house and drawings and plays and things like that. You know, that sort of connected to the movie, I think, in a way.
Would your mother encourage you to do that?
Yeah. And also she was an archaeologist, which is what the mother is in the movie. So there are some stuff that's kind of connected to my own family.
My guest is Wes Anderson, the director and co-writer of the new film, The Royal Tenenbaums. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the new film The Royal Tenenbaums, a comedy about a family of child geniuses who grow up to be messed-up adults. Anderson also directed and co-wrote Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. The song that really stands out that you used in your previous movie, Rushmore, was Summer Song, mm-hmm. By Chad and Jeremy. Talk about how you chose the records that you use in the background for The Royal Tenenbaums.
Right. Well, for me, the songs are always a part of the writing process. When we were doing Rushmore, I had this idea of British Invasion, and I just listened to lots of that, and I had some favorites that I liked. There was a song called Making Time by a band called The Creation that almost became like sort of the theme of the movie, I think. It sort of led me into this whole British Invasion thing. And the new movie, I felt like there was a song by Nico, written by Jackson Browne, but sung by Nico, and there was also this Ravel string quartet in F major. These two pieces of music I had from the beginning, and somehow I felt like there was something kind of half Scott Fitzgerald and half Velvet Underground that was going to be the sort of sound of the movie. And in a way, so it almost influenced the way the movie looks, I think, because when you're outside in the movie, it's a little bit like sort of 70s New York. There's a lot of graffiti and stuff, and it's kind of like the French Connection or the Warriors period of New York. But the inside, the rooms are inside, I feel like maybe they're more like the 30s or something. I don't know what. I feel like that sort of came out of the mixture of music, there is something to me sort of New York about a lot of the music, even though it's, you know, even though there's Beatles and there's Van Morrison, then there's something about the feeling of these songs that makes me think of New York.
I was wondering what was in your parents' record collection when you were growing up.
Well, my dad listened to jazz. He liked Chet Baker and. You know, he was sort of West Coast jazz. But I don't feel like I was that influenced by their music. Mm-hmm. My older brother was more of an influence with music, because he's more musical than I am. I mean, I can't even tune a guitar, and he has just perfect pitch. And so I always heard what he was listening to and sort of followed it.
What was he listening to when you were in your formative years?
He was listening to, you know, what was popular then, you know, like The Police or U2 and that kind of stuff. And Elton John was an early one that he introduced me to. But he was also listening to classical music because he was playing the piano. And so I kind of you know, learned a little bit about that from him, just from being in the next room.
You have some great actors in the Royal Tenenbaums, and Gene Hackman's at the center of the movie, and he's just so much fun to watch. I know you worked really hard to convince him to star in the film. What did you learn about how he works?
Well, I think he's quite different in his approach to a scene from anybody else I've worked with. There's something about him where he wants to be. He's very prepared when he arrives to do a scene, but he somehow manages to make it completely spontaneous as soon as he launches into it. And I don't think he even really knows what he just did after he finishes a take. He somehow manages to sort of take all this preparation and then just block it out and just dive into the scene. So whenever you're starting a scene with him, there's this real feeling of his attack to it and this energy that he brings to it. And it's very different from other actors who I've worked with. A lot of actors, which I enjoy also, is, you know, people who want to discuss it and think about it and want to try some different approaches. He likes to figure it out and then just launch right into it. What I really think he likes to do is to be great on the first take and just immediately, you know, grab a hold of it.
Do you ever run into trouble if somebody else was working slowly to the good take and they'd need like six takes, but Hackman wanted to do the first take?
Well, the thing with it is, he as much as he can sometimes nail it on the first take, he also gets better. And he's able to make any adjustment that you could possibly want. He's completely versatile. So I think he probably enjoys it more if he could just get it right off the bat. But if there are other people that are figuring other things out, he's not somebody who loses it over the takes. He absolutely maintains it.
It's funny, Gene Hackman and Owen Wilson are in your film, The Royal Tenenbaums. At the same time, they're also in this new military action film, Behind Enemy Lines.
Yeah, which I haven't even gotten to see because we've been working. We're just finishing this movie, but I'm dying to see it because I like to see the two of them going toe to toe.
Right.
I know Owen does a lot of running and climbing, and it's the
right.
First time that I'll get to see him doing that stuff.
Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the new film comedy The Royal Tenenbaums. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Mama Pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. And by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And Pamela Anderson, author of How to Cook Without a Book. And The Perfect Recipe, books for both novice and veteran cooks. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we look at the early use of chemical weapons in World War I with Eric Crotty, author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. And we continue our conversation with Wes Anderson, the director and co-writer of the new film, The Royal Tenenbaums.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Wes Anderson, director of the new film The Royal Tenenbaums, a new comedy about three child geniuses who have matured into totally messed up adults. The film stars Ben Stiller, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Luke Wilson as the children. Their separated parents are played by Angelica Houston and Gene Hackman. Wes Anderson also directed and co-wrote Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. His co-writer on each film has been Owen Wilson, one of the stars of Bottle Rocket and The Royal Tenenbaums. There's a TV interviewer who's basically, I think, a Charlie Rose type in your movie. It's a very small part, and the part is played by the actor Larry Pine, who's a great actor who was one of the stars of Vanya on 42nd Street, a production of
Louis Malle's.
Yeah. I was wondering about using a great actor for such a small part.
Well, I just wanted an excuse to get Larry Pine in there. I've just admired him for a long time, and we did a TV commercial together at one point, a Sony commercial that I managed to talk him into doing. And
what, you directed it?
Yeah. You see, I've only done one TV commercial, but it was with Larry Pine and Andrew Wilson. That was the cast, so I had a good time. In a way, I felt guilty because I wanted to have a bigger part for him or a fuller part for him, but I also knew he would just bring something immediately to it, and he sort of nailed it. I also saw him in Mike Nichols' production of The Seagull in Central Park over the summer. He was great in it. I mean, it was such a great production anyway. But Larry Pine was one of my favorite performances in it. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that's great.
You've worked with Owen Wilson on your three movies. He's co-written them, and he's starred in two of them. How did you meet?
Owen and I met, we went to school together in Austin. And we had a playwriting class together. We didn't actually meet in the playwriting class. We were in this class together with about five other people, but we were both the sort of non-participants in the room. Owen would just sit in the corner reading the newspaper, and I sat in the other corner. I was trying to write something during the class, but neither of us really quite joined in. But I think we recognized each other as kindred spirits or something. And then we met, shortly after that. I think I met him in the halls. He asked me about which creative writing class he ought to take. And he acted like we already knew each other. So I acted like we already knew each other, too.
Has it been interesting to know each other for so long and both end up with pretty successful careers?
I think we've been really lucky to have each other, as we kind of figure out all this movie stuff, because I think it can be pretty easy to lose your bearings a little bit. I feel like the Coen brothers, those guys seem so, secure in their whole approach to movies, and they seem just very like and I feel like the two of them going through all the stuff together have really helped to keep each other quite focused and sort of on track, and I feel like I'm glad to have had Owen and Luke also, and just to sort of so we can sort of guide each other a little bit.
Your movie has a kind of generosity of spirit, even though it's a comedy about a dysfunctional family and everybody's totally screwed up. There's a spirit of forgiveness, finally, and a sense that the good of family can really outweigh the bad. Is it easy for you to feel as generous in real life, both about family and about people maybe within the family who you've had to forgive?
I don't feel like I've had... my experiences with the family are not really like the ones in the movie, so I don't really feel that. I don't know. I guess everybody has a certain amount of that stuff. What I feel like is that the movies that we make, I'm drawn to some kind of optimism or something about the characters, and I want to have an affection for the characters. And I also feel like we're drawn to characters that are very flawed and capable of very questionable behavior. But somehow I always feel like I don't want to have bad guys. And I don't know exactly how that relates to how I feel in real life. But I don't know. That's the kind of movie that I'm drawn to.
Do you have children of your own? Are you married? Or
no.
Would it be an ambition for you to have a family?
Yeah, no, I do want to have a family, for sure.
I want to ask you something about the pacing of the movie. Early on in The Royal Tenenbaums, you're just finding out detail after detail about each of the children in the family. And there's so many, like, sight gags and verbal jokes, and it's just like one laugh after another. And the plot isn't necessarily advancing, but the character detail is. And at some point you're wondering, when is this going to slow down and the real story will evolve? And at about that point, it slows down and the story evolves. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about pacing the film and what you had to figure out with that.
Right. I was always a little worried because we do spend quite a bit of time on, basically what happens is we give this whole story of the family history. Then we introduce each character today. And there are eight main characters, and we introduce them in the bluntest way you can. We show an image of them with the name of the character and the name of the actor, and we go on to the next one. Then we go to the present. We revisit each in the present, and a narrator kind of walks us through where they are now. So we end up doing kind of three tours through all the characters, and it takes up the entire first reel of the movie. And I was always worried, can we do this? Can we spend this much time laying the groundwork? But I was also worried that if we didn't, it would just be completely confusing because there's so many characters and what they're up to is not really a very familiar territory. We were very conscious that once that was done, we needed to get right into the story. It may require some patience.
Well, did you go through it and say, how many jokes are there? How many, like, funny things happen in this, like, five-minute interval? Do we need to add more? How much calculation is there in how many laughs there are?
None. But I do feel like there are great directors who do that. I remember reading an interview with Fred Skipsey, who...
The Australian director.
Yeah, a great director who's made many great films. And he had a chart that he would sort of measure the level of tension and he would sort of gauge, you know, how the movie felt at different points and then try to sort of shape it to what he thought was a more ideal kind of graph, which is, you know, beyond me to figure out how to do that, but he clearly knows how to use that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the new film comedy The Royal Tenenbaums. It opens in New York and L.A. on Friday and in more cities over the holidays. Beginning December 24th, we're going to celebrate the holidays by celebrating great American music with a week-long encore presentation of our series on American popular song. One of the programs will be devoted to songwriter Hoagy Carmichael. Here's a song he co-wrote with Frank Lesser, Two Sleepy People, recorded by Bob Hope and Shirley Ross in 1938.
Here we are, out of cigarettes, holding hands and yawning. Look how late it gets.
Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight. Here we are in the cozy chair,
picking on a wishbone from the frigidaire. Two sleepy people with nothing to say,
and too much in love to break away.
Do you remember the nights we used to linger in the hall?
Yeah, Father didn't like you at all.
Whatever happened to him?
Remember the reason why we married in the fall?
to rent this little nest and get a bit of rest.
Well, here we are, just about the same. Foggy little fella,
drowsy little dame, two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight.
Here we are. Gee, don't we look a mess?
Lipstick on my collar.
And wrinkles in my dress. Two sleepy people by dawn's early light. And too much in love to say goodnight.
Here we are, crazy in the head. Gee, your eyes are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Even when they're red. Two sleepy people who know very well
they're too much in love to break the spell.
Do you remember the nights we used to cuddle in the car?
Uh-huh.
Watching every last fading star.
And remember the doctor said your health was under par.
And you, my little snooks, were ruining your looks.
Well, here we are, keeping up the pace.
Letting each tomorrow slap us in the face.
Two sleepy people by dawn's early light. And too much in love to say goodnight.
Bob Hope and Shirley Ross. Coming up, chemical warfare in World War I. This is Fresh Air. Ever since we discovered anthrax in the mail, Americans have had a new awareness and heightened fear of the possibility of biological and chemical attacks. Although it may seem like we're living in a new reality, chemical warfare played a big part back in World War I. My guest, Eric Crotty, is the author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. He's a senior research associate at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. I asked him to describe the chemical weapons that were used in World War I.
The first major chemical attack was chlorine in Ypres, Belgium. The German military basically hauled thousands of chlorine canisters up to the front and all at once opened them up when the winds were right and allowed a cloud of chlorine gas to drift towards the Allied forces. Chlorine really lost its effectiveness. It's a choking gas that primarily causes death through asphyxiation. Phosgene was another gas that was used to a considerable extent. Probably, however, in many ways, the more effective chemical warfare agent and used in large quantity in 1917 and 1918 was mustard agent. It's not so much because of its lethality, but because it caused so many contamination problems to the enemy, to either side, that it injured and incapacitated a lot of soldiers. So mustard, chlorine, phosgene are really the top in terms of actual battlefield use.
Mustard gas is what's called a blister agent, and that means what exactly? Blisters can be fairly harmless things.
Well, yes and no. It depends on the size and quantity of blisters, but also the infections that can occur following injury. And in World War I, there wasn't much in the way of antibiotic therapy, so this was a real concern, as a concern now. But mustard could be lethal, particularly in larger concentrations when it gets into the upper respiratory tract. And occasionally, given the right amounts, can go straight to the lungs and cause horrific damage. But by and large, you can think of mustard agent as being one that causes extreme irritation to the tissues, primarily through cell death down to the DNA level.
Were the Germans the only ones to use chemical weapons during World War One?
No, Germany was really in the best position to use them and to utilize chemicals because, as even now, Germany then owned a substantial market share in terms of a chemical industry. It's really remarkable how far advanced Germany was at that time in terms of dye manufacture, pharmaceuticals, and others. That gave them sort of an edge. But Fritz Haber, who was the father of modern chemical warfare, who worked for the German Wehrmacht, he too realized that, you know, Germany could use chemicals to a great extent and perhaps improve their chances in war. But he also told the German government that you better end this war quickly because the Allies will catch up. And so France, Britain, and America all sort of cooperated to develop their own chemical warfare agents to use as a responding in kind to how Germany used them on the battlefield. So it really was sort of a race, an arms race, if you will, in terms of developing chemicals that could be used effectively in the battlefield.
Did France or any other countries end up using chemicals?
Yes, France and Britain used them to a great extent. The United States supported. We were latecomers to that war, and we did what we could. But probably France and Britain were further along, much more so, in actual production and also tactics. The United States was sort of a slow learn in a lot of ways into the realm of offensive chemical warfare. Some American expeditionary forces did actually use some in battle, but it's sort of few and far between.
There were 500,000 Russian soldiers who were casualties as a result of chemical weapons during World War One. Do I have that figure right?
Yes. Russia and the former Soviet Union probably got the worst of it when it came to chemical warfare in World War One. And this is something that Solzhenitsyn writes about in November 1916. And in many ways, it helped to form the military doctrines that were to be later adopted in the Soviet Union by people such as Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who actually was the first to modify chemical warfare into some sort of doctrine. But yes, the experience that Russia had was really an object lesson in how, for troops that are unprepared, chemical warfare can be extremely devastating.
So you think part of the reason why the Soviet Union built such an arsenal of chemical weapons is because they were the victims of it?
I think that had a lot to do with it, that they have memories of just how important these agents could be in a battlefield scenario.
You open your book with a poem by the British writer Wilfred Owen, and this is a poem about facing chemical agents in World War One. Would you tell us why you selected it and then read it to us?
Well, we excerpted that just because it is a classic, and no book on chemical warfare would be complete without it. It describes in very accurate and vivid detail, really, the effects of gas, not only on the moral psyche of the soldier, but down to its effects on the lungs. And you get this with pulmonary fluid being filled up because of the damage to the lungs. You also get a fair amount of fluid, a frothy, pink blood-tinged fluid coming out of the mouth. And so in those days, and even now, you can refer that to as dry land drowning. The damage to the lung causes someone to basically choke on your own fluid. And just not too many other literary devices that one can find that describes it so well.
So Wilfred Owen wrote this poem in 1918. Would you read it to us?
Certainly. The poem is titled Dulce et Decorum Est. Gas, gas, quick boys. An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime, dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning.
Now, the clumsy helmets that he refers to, what are they?
He's trying to figure into the manic and frenetic pace of trying to get your masks or whatever you had.
So these were gas masks that they were putting on?
Probably ensembles, correct. Not only just the actual canister or mask itself, but if there was other attachments to it, because you'd probably have to take off your helmet, put on the gas mask. And there was a lot of different types, some better than others. In the early days, they put whatever they could find onto cheesecloth and covered their nose and mouths. Sometimes even urine was used as a means to provide some kind of a chemical barrier between you and the gas. And of course, in this particular poem, there's some points here. Gas, for example, is still used as a warning. Regardless of what agent is used, you'd yell out gas, and that gives all your comrades the heads up to put on your protective equipment.
My guest is Eric Crotty, author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Crotty, author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. When we left off, we were talking about the use of chemical weapons in World War I. So chemical weapons were a very potent weapon in World War I. Were they used in World War II?
Only in the Pacific theater, and to this is primarily the use of chemical weapons by the Japanese military against the Chinese Kuomintang and other forces in China proper. There are some reports that perhaps some Japanese soldiers threw cyanide at Allied forces in the Pacific War. None of this has been really confirmed, and certainly didn't come to any great effect. And the extent to which chemical weapons were used in China, it's hard to say what overall impact they made, but it was considerable.
During World War II, FDR pledged not to use chemical weapons unless those weapons were used against us first. But in 1942, he did threaten the Germans, saying that America would use chemical weapons against them if they used the chemical weapons against the Russians. What did we have that we were threatening with?
At that point, the United States had a considerable quantity of mustard agent primarily, plus some other World War I stocks. What we did not have were some of the newer nerve agents that Germany was developing almost precisely at that time. In a sense, the threat was, or at least the implied retaliatory threat, was very real, and it certainly was not lost on the German military. I think Roosevelt was just making sure that Germany understood that Russia, Britain, the United States were in it together, and that any attack on them was an attack on us. Now, Roosevelt said something similar to the effect that the use of chemical weapons by Japan against China would also be regarded in similar fashion, but we never really followed up on that threat. And to a certain degree, modern Chinese scholars and some in their security apparatus are still a little bit irked by that, perhaps.
Most countries would like to stop the production of chemical or biological weapons. On the other hand, several countries like the United States have nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapons cause immediate death to the people nearby and a fast death to the people on the periphery, and then a slow and painful death to many others. And the numbers can be remarkably high in nuclear war. In your understanding, why are nuclear weapons still acceptable for some countries like the United States to have, whereas mustard gas or anthrax are considered unthinkable?
That's an outstanding question, and I think too few people ask that. Regardless of what one feels about it, I think it's a fallacy, at least a scientific one, to ascribe a certain moral outrage of one weapon system while allowing another. And the example you mentioned there, for example, mustard agent, its effects on the body are described as radiomimetic, that is, it mimics that of radiation, particularly at the level of the DNA and the destruction it does to cell tissue, and with repeated exposures can lead to cancers. So they're really not very far removed from one another if you think about it, if you get right down to how cells are injured and die. But I think the United States went through the same type of decision-making when Nixon renounced biological warfare in 69. He and Kissinger sort of looked at each other and said, well, we've got a very powerful nuclear deterrent. What's the point messing around in a technology here that might only be used against us by some other countries? Maybe it's time for us to take the lead on this and see what we can do to slow it down. But yes, but that's a very Machiavellian approach to arms control, if you want to put it that way.
Machiavellian in what sense?
In the sense that giving up a weapon system with a means towards enhancing your own security advantage. That is, it's not so much of a morality play as it is to playing for your own set of cards. How are you going to stay on top of the security game?
You study biological and chemical weapons, you know, and how they've been used and what treaties have been come up with to try to prevent their use. Do you have nightmares about this stuff?
Not particularly. I think the nightmares I have, to the extent that I have them, are about more mundane things, about car accidents, my brakes not working. And these are the things that really bother me. And I think, you know, writ large, I think people should be worried about those things too, making sure your brakes work, making sure your smoke detector is still working. These are the types of risks that we really face. Chemical and biological warfare is still rather obscure, and it's an interesting subject, but as we try to promote in this book, we want people to understand it and not fear it.
Well, Eric Crotty, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Eric Crotty is the author of Chemical and Biological Warfare. He's a senior research associate at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Honorable Company, a novel of India before the Raj by Alan Mallison, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, HBO began rebroadcasts of its acclaimed series, 6 Feet Under. On the next Fresh Air, an interview with the show's creator, Alan Ball. He also wrote the screenplay for the film American Beauty. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.